I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. It's great to have you with us. Latinos in the United States are at the center of many of the biggest issues of our time. They're the second largest group to be affected by police brutality after Black Americans. They're disproportionately affected by COVID-19. Many of the essential workers that have kept our society running over the past 4 months have been immigrants from Latin America, who may also have been caught in the crosshairs of the Trump administration's anti-immigrant policies. At the same time, Latino civil rights organizations have struggled to organize large swaths of the community, which in itself is widely diverse in its language, immigration status, race, national origin, and political affiliation. So today on The Takeaway, we're examining what it would take to galvanize Latinos in the United States and address the issues most affecting them come November. For that and lots more, we called up Julian Castro. He's been the U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and also a 2020 presidential candidate. Julian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
Secretary, I want to start by saying that I understand that COVID-19 affected your family recently, and I'm very sorry to hear about your stepmother.
Well, thank you very much for the condolences. You know, we lost our stepmother, Alice. Alice and my father were married for 31 years, and she was a wonderful woman, a fantastic wife and mother and stepmom to my brother Joaquin and me. And it's difficult these days because families are unable to grieve in the usual way that you do because of when somebody dies with COVID-19.
It's something that has really changed the way we live in so many ways. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to have this conversation with you specifically was because Latinos are now at the center of so many of the issues that are happening in this country, and COVID-19 is among them. It has been devastating Latinos across the country. We spoke to the mayor, Kate Gallego of Phoenix, yesterday on our show, and we've spoken to Mayor Francis Suarez in Miami on the show about these populations and how they're faring, and the numbers are rising at an alarming rate of Latinos who not only have coronavirus but are dying from coronavirus. What do things look like where you are in Texas right now, Secretary?
Here in Texas, it's a lot of the same story. Overall in the state, we see a rise in the number of cases, hospitalizations, and now the number of deaths related to COVID-19. And also the Latino community bearing a disproportionate share of that for many of the reasons that people have cited. And really vulnerabilities that existed well before this pandemic. People that have to go out to work because they can't do their job from home. Folks that are not getting adequate health care to begin with, especially in a state like Texas that hasn't expanded Medicaid. Folks who have underlying conditions. You know, I have a mom who has diabetes. My grandmother passed away years ago from complications related to diabetes. And with COVID-19, an underlying condition like diabetes definitely makes you more susceptible to a harder time with it. So for so many reasons, the Latino community is especially struggling right now.
Do you have a message for our country's leaders about COVID-19 and how it relates to communities of color specifically? Because not only are Latinos being affected, but Black Americans and indigenous populations are also bearing the brunt.
My message would be pay attention to what's going on. If you really care, take the time to understand why and understand that there are things that we can do to make sure that we rewrite that story in the future. In other words, getting health care to every single person in this country, making sure that every single person has a safe, decent, affordable place to live in this country, ensuring that people have the dignity of work, but also are paid what they should be with the kind of benefits that they should be. Because what we're seeing today is just the culmination, just a demonstration of the shortcomings of making a commitment to people in this country that has fallen disproportionately on people of color. And so I'd say to policymakers, like, pay attention and learn the why and the how of how we can make it better in the future.
In addition to the coronavirus pandemic, we are also experiencing what a colleague of mine in journalism, Aaron Haynes, often calls a pandemic within a pandemic, which is the uprising for racial justice that we've seen across the country. What's underpinning that uprising, Secretary, as you know, are the police killings of Black Americans. But we also know that Latinos are the second largest group to have been killed by police and experience police brutality. Thinking of the killings of Carlos Ingram Lopez in Tucson, Andres Guardado in Los Angeles. It was found recently that Andres was shot 5 times in the back after an independent autopsy. Where do you see the role of Latino activists in the larger uprising for racial justice in this country right now, given where Latinos and how Latinos have also been experiencing police brutality?
You know, when you looked at those pictures of people in the streets protesting, or, you know, I went and participated, I bet a lot of the listeners participated in one of the protests. It was wonderful to see people of all different backgrounds marching for equality and marching against police brutality, including Latinos. And the role, I think, of the Latino community is to tell our stories, also to stand in solidarity with the Black community and all folks who are affected by this, and to make sure that we work in every single way, protesting on the streets, the policymakers that you now have that are Latino in city halls across the United States and state legislatures and the halls of Congress, to activate themselves on these policies and make the changes that should be made. In every single way, people can play a role in changing that. With the Latino community, you know, police violence and excessive force has long been used against Latinos. You know, that's nothing new. I don't think it's gotten the same attention over the years.
I know here on The Takeaway, we've tried to focus on some of the cases that have been emerging in the past couple of months, particularly that of Andres Guardado and others. But why do you think it hasn't gotten the same attention? Is it the media that isn't doing the job?
I mean, I think that oftentimes in the narrative of America, Latinos are sort of pushed to the side, even though the Latino community has become the largest minority group in the country. And I think that there are different reasons for that. But I saw that, I really did see that running for president, the different ways in which that happens. And I think it's true that in our country, you know, people of color generally, you know, your story is not told and taught in history classes in so many different ways. You know, the media don't focus on the perspective of people of color and generally in the way that stories are put together. The newsrooms themselves are not diverse. So I think this applies to, you know, whether it's the Black community or Latino community or others. But I think that for the growth that we've seen in the country of the Latino community, and the fact that the Latino community has been here since before the founding of the country, like the Native American community, you don't see a commensurate amount of attention on these types of issues. And, you know, I mean, it's head scratching in terms of why that is. I don't think there's any one answer to that. And I don't think there's a good answer to that, because I think that it should be covered.
You know, when we talk about this big group, Latinos in the United States, we're talking about so many different kinds of people from so many different places who speak so many different languages, who are a multitude of races. Could that be, Secretary Castro, why it's so difficult for this group, Latinos, if you will, to coalesce behind a movement for civil rights and social justice? When we see incidents of police violence, there are protests that happen in that community, for example, where that the violence happens there. But we have yet to reach a national fever pitch where Latinos have really coalesced around an idea, a person, or anything of the sort. I don't understand why that is. Is it because we're so diverse, or is it because we just can't seem to galvanize ourselves to do that?
I mean, I think there are at least two challenges. First is that the mainstream media, they one-dimensionalize the Latino community. Even though it's as diverse as you've said, with people of different national origin, people that have been here for generations versus folks who, you know, are recent immigrants, folks that are English dominant versus folks that are bilingual, and then folks that are Spanish dominant. In the narrative of the mainstream media, the Latino community basically got here 5 minutes ago, and they're all concerned about whether they're going to be visited by ICE tomorrow.
It's largely an immigrant narrative.
That's right. It's an immigrant narrative. Now, look, that's a very important and meaningful, you know, narrative and experience in the United States for Latinos and generally. At the same time, that doesn't represent the fullness of the Latino experience. But so the way that translates into how Latinos are covered is that if it has to do with immigration, you know, they're all right there. You know, you're getting a lot of coverage. Hey, you know, let's figure out what Latinos have to say about this. But if it deals with something else, whether it's police violence or jobs in the economy or healthcare or technology or you name it, well, that's not really, that's not a Latino issue. They're not going to, they're not going to focus oftentimes on that aspect of that issue with regard to Latinos. You're put into this narrative where everything that immigration and related issues there, that's like the zone that Latinos are put in by the mainstream media. And on the flip side of it, with the diversity that exists in the community itself, I mean, people are human beings, you know, they're made up of different aspirations and identities within them, you know, the community, and not just national origin, but professions or what they do for work or as parents or whatever it is, like everybody. And for Latinos, they're coming from different places and they have different experiences in this country. And so it's natural that there wouldn't necessarily be one monolithic political view or, social view or even reaction to the events of today. And that does make it more challenging a lot of times to summon up a common purpose and sense of like, we're going to go do this and this is the mission. Yeah, I mean, I think that it makes it harder just substantively to do that. There, it's been long said, there is no Latino or Latina leader, national leader, right? One person that's been identified as that. I think that can be good and that can be bad. But it does make it, I think, harder to organize.
I want to ask you about the national civil rights organizations for Latinos and how you see their role in leading the community at this time.
Our national civil rights organizations need a refresh, frankly. That's not to say that they don't have some great talent and some good work that's happening, but I think I and a lot of folks feel like many of them need a refresh to meet the challenges of the 21st century and meet the Latina community, you know, where we are today. You know, for me, as a Latino politician, that because I ran for president and have served in the administration and so forth, probably has higher name ID than most others. But for me, or for an individual in that position, you know, like I was running for president. And the conundrum you get into is, you know, that if you run for president, if you become president, you have to represent everybody. That you can't run for president as the Latino candidate only, because you won't get elected. And so for those of us that are stepping up, even now in this time period, you're still kind of forced to make this choice of, do I do justice to vocalizing all of the needs within this community that are so great and that I feel a responsibility for, and that I know from personal experience, having grown up in it. But I know if I do that, that I'm easily going to get seen as just the brown guy. And then you're not going to win. You're not going to become president, or if you're running for senator or governor. That is a choice that people still have to make, even now. So I think the positive of there not being one leader is, look, people throughout the country in their own right, whether in politics, in organizing and activism, in business, can step up and be leaders in their own right. And I think that that's empowering to some extent.
There is a recent, or there's been, I should say, a recent dust up, if you will, in the Latino community, very recent. This past week, Secretary, speaking of Latino leaders and people who are recognizable, perhaps this name isn't recognizable, but the product sure is. Goya Foods CEO praised President Trump at the White House, which then, as we all know, has, if anyone's been on social media over the past couple of days, sparked a boycott against the company's products and the hashtag Goya Way on Twitter. What does this tell us about this monolith, the Latino community, right? People seem to, and I should be clear, Goya products aren't just used by Latinos. I saw lots of folks who said, you know, who are not Latino saying, I want to get rid of my Goya products, or how do I make my own adobo? But I think this, you know, as much fun as people are having with this on social media, I do think it points to something bigger here. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on the boycott itself, but really what it says about our community when it comes to our politics. I think there were people who were very surprised that there are Latinos who are Republican, who are supporters of the president.
Well, there are. And, you know, I mean, I'm here in Texas. And so that something that we see every day, Texas Latinos tend to have more conservatives than you would find in California, New York, Florida. Well, you know, Florida, you've had the Cuban American community, but even that has been changing recently. But we don't have a community that is of just one mind, that is monolithic. You know, it is basically Democratic community and you know, center left, I think. But you do have a strong element still of people who are conservative, and even some that still support Trump, although I think that's a diminishing number of people in 2020 versus 2016. But to me, the when Bob Unanue said, right next to the president in the Rose Garden at a campaign style event, that we're truly blessed to have Donald Trump as a leader because he's a builder. It felt like a betrayal. And it felt like a betrayal because here's a man and a family that over the generations has made a lot of money, gotten rich off of the hard-earned dollars of the Latino community mostly, who have been very loyal consumers. And the thing is, he should understand, and CEOs out there should understand, that we live in a different time. If corporations are going to go out there and pay millions of dollars to high-priced lobbyists to try and affect policy, if folks like Bob are going to contribute to campaigns the way that he has, and if they're going to stand in the Rose Garden and publicly praise a bigoted president that has harmed Latinos in this country, people are going to pay attention. Consumers are not going to give you a pass anymore because they want to know what your values are. Just like your advertising tries to make people feel a certain way, well, your political words and contributions and actions also make people feel a certain way. And so free speech works both ways. He can stand up there and say whatever he wants. He can support whatever candidate he wants. That's the country we live in. But, you know, I and so many other people can either choose his products or somebody else's products, because that's the country we live in too.
I have to say, there were some very enterprising folks taking advantage of the moment, smaller adobo makers, for example, and sofrito recipes abounding on social media. So yeah, I thought that was an interesting point. And I did also see the sort of back and forth over what constitutes free speech and what doesn't. But I also think that this concept of, you know, what we're talking about right now almost leads us into the next question, which is, there have been a lot of conversations about race. And I think we're getting to a point, or we've gotten to a point in this country, where race is being interrogated in the United States, and rightfully so. And that a lot of that is happening within the Latino community, specifically when we talk about anti-Black racism among Latinos and within our own community. And that's become a huge part of the conversation, if you will. Where can you talk a little bit about how you see anti-Blackness playing out among the Latino community? Because for me, I feel like there are issues that need to be interrogated. And then there's also the fact that there are Latinos who themselves are Black and part of the Black diaspora. Where do we stand with that conversation today? Are we doing enough to interrogate anti-Blackness?
Well, I don't think we are. I mean, I think we're just scratching the surface in the Latino community. I mean, it's something that people have known about. I mean, you turn on Univision or Telemundo, or look at these telenovelas and look at the TV coverage, and you notice that colorism exists very clearly. You know, a tendency to still favor white appearing people and an anti-Blackness. Even though, as many have pointed out, you know, the number of Latinos that identify as Afro-Latino has grown, and I think it's, you know, by one estimate I saw, in the 20% range. And recently, you know, we've had some cause for hope. We've seen folks like Candace Valenzuela, that just won a primary in Texas' 24th congressional district, that if she wins in November, would be the first Afro-Latina to go to Congress. You have in New York, I think, Richie Torres. So a number of people that I think represent the future. And hopefully that will help the Latino community grapple with the anti-Blackness that does exist. And ultimately to recognize, I think this is where we can recognize a strength, right? Because to be Latino means you could be Black, you could be white, you can be indigenous. I think that's a strength. And I think that gives us a vantage point to be part of the conversation and a healing in this country that everybody wants of different backgrounds.
Turning now to, there's so many issues to really unpack here. I want to go back a moment to coronavirus, because, or the effect that the coronavirus pandemic is having longer term. We've been looking here on The Takeaway about what happens now that a lot of the federal protections are being taken away, or state protections are being taken away. That's in terms of housing protections, eviction moratoriums, additional unemployment benefits. And so we're really looking at a cliff coming up if state and federal officials don't move to keep people housed. So we know that when it comes to housing, Secretary, you were the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. You know firsthand that these issues also disproportionately affect Black and Brown Americans. Now, back in 2016, you were criticized by progressives for the way that you approached foreclosed homes during the 2008 crisis. There were lots of criticisms about how the 2010 distressed asset stabilization program was handled. Some said that it gave Wall Street more of the upper hand to take over these homes. When you look back at your history here and you look at, see where we are today with the looming threat of evictions and potentially foreclosures and more, what would you do differently? What would you do right now in 2020, knowing that this crisis, we're at the cliff, if you will, of this another housing crisis potentially?
Well, you need to make sure that people can stay in their homes. So, number one, we need to extend and expand eviction moratoriums and prevent foreclosures in this immediate time period during this pandemic, where still about 20 million people have not been able to go back to work. They're unemployed. We also need to provide direct rental assistance. That's something that the HEROES Act that Congress has, you know, the Senate, Mitch McConnell and his buddies in the Senate have on their doorstep right now that the House already passed. In the long run, though, Tanzina, we need to see housing as a human right. We need to work toward a day when everybody in this country has a safe, decent, affordable place to live. That means we're going to need a recommitment to investing in housing. You know, Vice President Biden has proposed investing $640 billion in a new supply of housing. I think that's a great plan, that we should do that. In addition to that, he's addressing the demand side of it in making universal the Housing Choice Voucher Program. There in New York, people are very familiar with the shortcomings of both the Housing Choice Voucher Program and public housing. It's time that we have a recommitment to actually providing, you know, meeting families halfway and providing good housing for people.
Housing is very important. I myself spent the first 20 years of my life in public housing in New York, so I can understand many of those issues intimately. Secretary, as you mentioned, you were a presidential candidate. You were the only Latino presidential candidate. And when you ended your presidential bid in January, you said, quote, "It simply is not our time." What will it take to make it time for a Latino president in this country?
Well, that's going to happen. I think a Latina or a Latino is going to be elected president in the not too distant future. And, you know, it's going to be at the right moment. And, you know, when somebody comes along that has both the moment and I think the everything else, the experience and the vision and so forth, I just felt like this wasn't the right moment. In fact, if there's one lesson that I learned, political lesson that I learned running in a 25 candidate field, was that the person that wins the nomination and then that, of course, becomes president is really the person that meets the moment the most. And whether you think back at Kennedy or, you know, Clinton or Obama, or even in I think, you know, a odd way, Trump in 2016, you know, it's always somebody that meets a certain moment. And I think Joe Biden meets the moment this time. People want to know that they have a president there that is going to be steady and has experience and has wisdom to make the right decisions and represents everything that this president we have right now isn't.
A lot of voters also wanted someone who was either a woman or a person of color or both, and they lost that opportunity this time as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, of course, if I didn't think that I couldn't have done a great job as president, I wouldn't have run myself. And I'm proud of the campaign that we did run. Many of the issues that I brought up in that campaign, whether it was police violence or housing or a number of other issues that we spoke up on, I think, oddly enough, are resonating more now that we're going through what we're going through than they did a year ago. But hopefully it set a vision that, you know, that others will pick up the baton from in the future.
Julian Castro is the former mayor of San Antonio, former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and former 2020 presidential candidate. Mr. Castro, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.